Do you like books? I mean, really, really like books? Then you're in the right place. Each week, your host, Sam Hankin, interviews the best of today's top-selling authors and the up-and-coming superstars of modern literature. This is The Avid Reader. Here is your host, Sam Hankin.
Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to another edition of The Avid Reader. Today, our guest is Samantha Coho, author of The Golden Fury, her first novel, published in October by Wednesday Books. A Golden Fury is considered a YA book, I suppose, but I think it could easily be read by a precocious 10-year-old up to an 80-year-old semi-senescent person, excluding, of course, our current president. I won't do that again. That's just one time. So Thea Sevilla Hope is an alchemy adept, not an alchemist yet, as her mother is, and many more people hope to be. She's honest, she's trustworthy, and more than anything, she wishes to complete every alchemist's dream of fashioning the fabled Philosopher's Stone. So a couple of problems, though. She's in the wrong country at the wrong time. She has a boyfriend who has some serious issues, a father who is clueless, a couple ways, and a curse that surrounds all that she is attempting to accomplish. So along the way, she gathers friends and enemies, and as she travels towards her goal, which brings her to a climactic choice, leads either to a darkness worse than hell, or a sacrifice she or anyone would be loath to make. Anyway, welcome, Samantha, and thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
So, tell us about adverbs first, your love-hate relationship.
You know what? So I think you're referring to my bio where I refer to adverbs several times. I think every writer starts out by using a lot of descriptive words, thinking that if they pack enough in, then they're really going to like make their point better. And then you realize that actually, if you've made your point well enough, you can do it simply. My journey has been to learn to do without adverbs, but now I'm actually starting to add them in again, because you know what? They can be useful when you use them, right?
I know. And in the biography, the biographer person are using them all the time. Then you're eliminating them.
Yeah. No, I've come back around. I'm putting them back in. I like adverbs.
And I won't. Okay, I said I wouldn't, but I will mention Trump again, because I love when he uses the word strongly.
Yeah.
Well, so let's talk a little bit. I tend to veer, but I'll get back to the book, and that's what we're here for. Tell us a little bit about alchemy and the steps an alchemist would take until he reaches that coveted goal, and what that coveted goal actually is.
So, alchemists believed there were sort of three main steps. There was the white and the black and the red. And that ended up being, it's very symbolic. It was taken up a lot by theologians, actually. The idea being that there's sort of a death stage, that's the black, and then a purification stage, which is the white, and then the red is the color of the Philosopher's Stone, and that's sort of this life color. So alchemists obviously, unfortunately, did not actually succeed in this, but they had similar ideas that in order for alchemy to work, there needed to be a purification that goes on. And there were a lot of different theories behind how they thought this purification would work. There were medieval alchemists dealt with they had the idea of the elements, right? That the world was composed of elements, the earth, air, fire, water. And they thought there was this other idea of this other element called quintessence. So if they could purify these elements enough, it would become this sort of pure element that could be anything. And that's one of the theories that underlay the idea that there could be a philosopher's stone that could do all this transmuting and saving and purifying. There were a lot of them, obviously, a lot of theories. None of them ultimately, unfortunately, worked, which is why my book's a fantasy novel.
Well, it's also good, without giving spoilers away, that kind of work, but
There's a bit of a, there's a twist.
Hey, weren't you mad? Not even mad. Irritated when they changed Harry Potter and the Philosopher's Stone to Harry Potter and the Sorcerer's Stone, like Americans wouldn't get it.
You know, when I first read that book, I think I was too young to be mad about it. But in retrospect, definitely. Now I'm mad, especially, I mean, I'm grateful for all reviews. But sometimes they do call it the Sorcerer's Stone instead of the Philosopher's Stone in some of the reviews that I've been seeing of my book. And that always makes me want to be like, oh, no, that's not a real thing.
And it's two words that have completely different meanings. You know, you get a vibe from both of them. But one more question before we get to the story itself. So there's so many arcane references, like to Jabut, if I'm pronouncing it right, and Hermes Trismegistus, if I'm pronouncing that right. So was this like stuff that you were obsessed with when you were a kid, or was this all through research, or was it something you actually thought maybe you could accomplish?
I wish. Yeah, that would be cool if I'd like tried alchemy myself, and then I was like, I guess I'll write fiction. So I have been interested in alchemy for a while. I would say I came to it more not as a kid, but like I read a lot of philosophy and sort of history and history of science in college, and when you do that, you come across alchemy all the time. Like, it just keeps coming up as this fun little sideshow, because a lot of the most important scholars who were known for other things had interests in alchemy as a hobby, like Isaac Newton, you wouldn't think, but was really into alchemy. So it keeps coming up because alchemy does have all this philosophical underpinning and theological underpinning. So it's interesting just from that perspective, from the historical perspective. And then of course, if you like fantasy, it's magic. So it's exciting.
Yeah, it's a topic that, you know, like I thought a lot about in my life, and it's like just the possibility that something like this could exist. Right. And then back then, it wasn't the possibility, it was really a task that seemingly could be accomplished. Yeah. That was what so was amazing for me. So all the characters are so well developed. So before I go too far astray, just tell us a little bit about the book.
Okay. Yeah. So it's the story of Thea. She's a young alchemist. She's an apprentice to her mother, as you said, not quite her own alchemist yet. But her mother is a famous alchemist. They live in France on the eve of the French Revolution, and they're close to the biggest discovery that alchemy promises, which is making the Philosopher's Stone. And her mother goes violently mad. And Thea has to leave, both because of that and because of the French Revolution. So she goes to Oxford, where her father does not know she exists. He's also an alchemist. Well, I guess things develop from there. There's a tension all throughout between this drive, the ambition of alchemy, and the sort of warning that what it produces might not turn out the way they hope.
What's interesting, and I said, you know, the characters are well developed, and I always know if a book is good because I can remember the names of the characters in my head.
Oh, great. That's awesome.
But you know, they're all, well, Thea is really good. And the other ones, the other characters, you know, well, Dominic is really good too. But the others all have kind of like an admixture, which is a good word for alchemy. Mm-hmm. They have this admixture of qualities. And so if you, and Thea even, you remember that scene in Lord of the Rings with where Frodo hands the ring to Galadriel? And she goes into this thing where she pretends like she, and then she says, I could have been this.
Yeah.
And then she gives it back.
Yeah. I love that.
Yeah, I love that too. And that's kind of like where Thea is, kind of in a way.
Yes.
And Marguerite, okay, so Marguerite is her mother.
Yes.
And Marguerite gets to the point where, and tell me if I get too close to saying something you don't want me to say, but so Marguerite gets to the point where she kind of is there.
Yeah.
And you think at the beginning, oh, she's this horrible, horrible person. But then, like I said, with all your characters, you kind of think, well, just like she says to Thea, you know, I know you might not believe this anymore, but I'm just looking out for you. And
right.
Thea says, no, I don't believe it anymore.
Mm-hmm.
But then you as the reader eventually come around to realizing that she did, even though she was kind of a bitch.
Yeah. No, I agree with that. Yeah. I think that she really was. She really was doing the best that she knew how to do. Her best is like not good enough. Unfortunately, that is often the case with parents, that we do our best and it's not good enough. But she has the added complication of what's happening with her alchemy. Don't want to spoil that, but so there's she seems worse than she is, but also a lot of the Thea's experience of her really is pretty terrible. But it's because she has, you know, she's also been complicit in this. She bought into her mother's ambition for her completely. And they were both working for the same goal, which was for Thea to be a great alchemist.
And then the idea of the stone, like, choosing whatever it chooses without getting too close to that. It also kind of bends and twists the characters. Even her father, Master Dr. Vellacott. But then you take Will, for example. And at first, you know, you think this, and then you think something else, and then you think something else. So that's pretty cool to be able to do that for the reader. Because,
thank you.
But you know what I mean, right? I mean,
yeah. First,
and then, you know, and this is close too, but at the end when he returns to his like semi-Adonis like state, you're pretty mean to what that means.
Wait, really? What was mean about it?
Because if he's in the state he was just prior, there's not much more you can do to him. But
right.
then now Martin can take his instruments and he's in really good shape. And
yeah,
I thought that was really, it was cruel, but it was really cool too.
Yeah, I do have a little bit of a cruel streak. Although I think a lot of people think Will gets off easy. Although that's a spoiler.
Oops. I don't mind if I get someone else. If I get the author to say it, I have guilt.
Yeah.
But going through the characters, it is hard to talk about them. But we can talk about Dominic because he just... Oh, that's
good.
Okay. Yeah, Dominic is just a good guy who does his best. And especially when he confesses.
Mm-hmm.
And it shows, you know, and I'm not really religious, but it shows the true power of what confession can be.
Yeah, and Thea has a moment of thinking about that, of like, what would I do if I found myself in this situation? Like, I don't have anything like this because I'm basically trying to be a god myself, right? Like, her ambition is such that she isn't leaving room for the possibility of something else that could give her, you know, forgiveness. She wants to take, the highest place that she can reach. There's just no humility in her goals, basically. Whereas to seek forgiveness requires humility. And so it's powerful to her to see that happen and just sort of imagine what it would be like to be that kind of person, which is a different kind of person.
And the pride that she feels, which is another good thing you do, is that you don't think of it as a vice.
Right.
You know, like, you don't, although pride doth go up before a fall. That was not a spoiler. That was just
that's just a proverb.
Right. But the other thing that was really cool about the book is, you know, I'm not going to get into this idea of empowerment and empowering girls to do that, but the thing about it was cool is that, okay, there's Dominic, there's Will, There's even Valentin, which I thought for a while maybe they're going to, you know.
And if anybody writes fanfic about this book, that would happen.
Yeah.
For sure.
Yeah. Yeah, at the very end. So what I'm getting at is, like, with those three guys, you think, okay, with the guy, if it was written, if she was a guy, that would be, you could do that fine. But usually the girl is supposed to be, like in The Princess Bride, she's supposed to be laying there and screaming and standing away from the action and the violence. Here she's just, you know, yeah, you're fine. I like you. And I made a mistake. But you expect at the end, normally, okay, she'd fall into the arms of somebody.
Right.
And she doesn't. And it's really cool.
Thank you. Yeah, I it's not that I didn't consider it, right? Like, I think especially in YA, it's very standard. The YA audience loves good romance, which is not which is totally understandable. I love a good romance, but it felt like for me this story was a story about Thea learning things about herself that just wouldn't lead to her wanting to, like you said, fall into the arms of a man at the end of it. I'm not saying she's not going to have successful romance in her life at some future date, but that was not this story. It felt true to me. I think friendships sometimes get undervalued. I don't know, just in general, but especially in YA novels. And I wanted to write a book that highlighted friendship maybe a little more as a reward, as a happy ending.
Yeah. And the funny thing is, I wasn't just ignoring you down trying to find the cover because I had this as a arc. And the cover is really cool because, you know, usually on the YA, they have like the profile of a girl. You don't see all of her.
Mm-hmm.
And here you just have a really cool border and not a girl kind of yearning for anything, although she is yearning tremendously for what. Oh yeah, for what she's
beautiful cover. I wanted to share it.
Oh yeah, I was going to ask you that. Did you vet it? Did they give you several of them, or did you have an idea? You know,
I'm not a very visual person. I sent them sort of some symbols that I thought were cool, things that ended up, like I was like all about the Ouroboros, big thing in alchemy, and, the sun and the moon. And so I sent them a bunch of sort of vibe type, you know, medieval woodcut things that were not going to be useful really for a YA cover. But then they sent me some early drafts. It's just an incredible designer, Carrie Resnick, just worked on it, and she did a great job.
Yeah.
The first ones, it was roughly this, but the color was different, and somehow the color made a huge difference.
Yeah. That's my favorite. That blue is my favorite blue. That's my favorite color.
It's beautiful. I just moved, but I had a room in my house actually that was painted this color.
So
I don't know how she knew.
I did one of those side walls, you know, like an accent.
Yeah. It was for me too. It was an accent situation.
Yeah. You don't want to do the whole room kind of.
Yeah.
Now looking at it, yeah, there's so many different aspects. I didn't really look at it closely, but yeah, the hourglass and then the flame. And then, like you said, on the side, which I don't see, but
yeah, here's the spine, I think, is gorgeous.
Yeah. And it's funny too, because another thing in YA is, you know, you're bringing in history. Yeah. Why did you put, you didn't have to put it in the place that it was.
Yeah.
It's a danger. And I'll just leave that. And you can, if you want to, you can explain where she is and at what time in terms of history.
Honestly, I've been asked this question a couple times, and I've like sort of tried to remember why I picked this time. I do think it's like a little bit after the heyday of alchemy. What I liked about it is that you have Enlightenment ideas coming in at this time, and like with the French Revolution and you know, sort of sweeping across Europe, and they sort of clash with alchemy. So I liked the idea of alchemists who have absorbed this sort of enlightened enlightened scientific approach, but are treating alchemy that way. So that influenced the time that I wanted to have it. Also, I just really like the French Revolution, so I sort of couldn't resist that. But also, it's a time with a lot of upheaval, right? Like not just in France, but there's war looming. Right after, of course, the American Revolution. And I like the idea of a time that's right on the cusp of big change as a setting for a story about alchemy changes, I guess, without giving too much away. I'll leave it there.
The thing about that I like about certain YA authors is that, okay, here you set the scene for the French Revolution. And it's going to give somebody who reads this the idea, oh, I want to learn more about this.
Yeah, I hope so. Yeah. I when I read historical fiction as a kid, and now too, it always made me do that. It always sent me to do more reading and like, oh, that's interesting.
Yeah. And like I was saying earlier about, let me look at my notes. How do you pronounce it anyway? Is it Jabit?
Okay, so I'm not 100% sure. I know we went over this for the audiobook. I think it's Jabir.
Jabir, okay. That's
yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And so, like, that would be one of the things that, you know, if you're going to be interested in that, and then that's one of the things I did. I went to Wikipedia and looked them up because...
Right. Mm-hmm.
And it's much more so now because you don't have to go out to the encyclopedia.
The library, yeah. Right. Yeah.
You can do it in an instant. So, yeah. I think that's great. And then the other thing, of course, is your background in Latin.
Mm-hmm.
And so you use that somewhat, and then people are going to look that up too.
Yeah, you know? I always have enjoyed that fantasy authors made Latin cool. You know, like I think in general, a lot of my Latin students came, or well, my Latin students took Latin because they had to because of the school that it was. But a lot of Latin students in general become interested in it because it is like it's used a lot in fantasy novels and historical novels. And so I wanted to do my bit, you know. Well, plus it's natural because it was the language of scholarship and alchemy and religion and all the things that it gets used for.
Yeah. And I took it only because I was going to go to law school and I figured, well, I must also get a running start into
prosaic but practical.
And it's funny, you know, and I'm sure you've come across this many times, you know, people telling you, why are you teaching this? It's a dead language. And it's not at all. It's right. Around us every day. And
yeah,
a lot of our language wouldn't be there if it wasn't for it, which I guess is maybe your starting lecture. I don't know.
No, it is. Yeah, I've got a lot of versions of that lecture. yeah, and the sort of, you know, really practical one is just like, you're going to do great on your SATs, which is true, but it's not the fun reason to learn Latin. The fun reason is just that it opens up a lot to you.
What percentage of your students do you think, like, really get hooked on it? I mean, 10, 20%?
Yeah, it's not all of them. It's not all of them, unfortunately, but some definitely.
Well, so when we're talking to the characters and about, you know, they're conflicted when they get to a certain point in their search, they find that if they're not the chosen one, that they go into, well, Thea too, they get into a position that's horrible.
Yeah.
And so that colors your idea of whether they're good or bad people. Whether it's Thea's father or whether it's Will or whether, but you're not with Dominic and you're not with, with Bentivoglio, you kind of are because he seems like that kind of guy anyway.
Yeah.
And, but then in a different way, and if I'm pronouncing it right, Rahel, she's just nasty, but
she's got some reason to be. Yeah. But yes, yeah, she is. Yeah.
Yeah, and there's one unseen character that also plays an important part, and that's always good when you do that too.
Yeah, I thought I really enjoyed that character because I really did feel like I had a sense of her, even though I didn't really, you know, I never wrote a scene with her. She never gets lines. I had a sense of her from everyone else's reaction to her and from her room. And yeah, she felt like as much of a real character as the rest of them, which was interesting because in a way the characters around her were creating her almost as much as I was, is how it felt to me. That's probably sounds weird, but.
No, I mean, like when Valentin sees her first in the dress and he's like appalled and wants to hit her. But then at the end he says she would have liked you.
Mm-hmm.
No?
Yeah.
I think, was he like your most fun character to create? Because he's kind of like such a complex character and has so many reasons to be different, like the way he treats Martin from time to time and all those kinds of things.
I definitely have a soft spot for him. Yeah. I mean, I always find characters who are cast in the role of villains, but aren't, it's not a natural fit for him, right? Like he's got a villain job, but he's not really a villain deep down. And he has to sort of work that out. I do always find that to be an interesting sort of type. So yeah, he's definitely one of my favorite characters. I think my very favorite is probably Dominic, but just because he's such a sweetheart and I do such terrible things to him. And I feel bad about it. So that's why I have a soft spot for him too. Yeah.
Yeah, that's not cruelty like you do to Will, but but he's hung up for such a long time, and Marguerite is, geez, I mean.
Yeah, I didn't mind torturing her a little bit.
Yeah, but the thing about it is that, you know, this concept that, you know, we all fear death, mm-hmm. we obviously all fear hell, and then you take it to something beyond what we think of as an absolute in everyday life. And that's hard to imagine, but you kind of, it's almost impossible to do, I guess, because you're all your life, you're inculcated to believe that these are the absolutes, like good and evil, black and white, light and dark. And you're taking us beyond that. Mm-hmm. That's also a good thing for a reader to envision or try to envision.
Yeah, I think what you were talking about earlier with the way that the stone chooses, it's really not. It doesn't choose based on good and evil, right? If it did, it would have chosen Dominic, you know, rather, or, I mean, maybe Thea, but maybe Thea's just better at alchemy. But I left it a little bit unclear what exactly the grounds for that were, that choice were in the book. But I have my own sort of secret idea for what I think they were.
Well, you know, it's funny because since I'm the reader, I get to do whatever I want.
Right.
So I just looked at that it was choosing a vessel.
Yeah.
And the vessel had to be perfect. It couldn't have like a little crack in a beam of steel that causes a building to collapse or something like that. It had to be the perfect vessel. And for whatever reason.
Yeah, that's right. I think it does choose Thea because she's the best, right? She's the best at what she's doing. And that's what she and her mother have been trying to make her all this time, right? So the irony is that she really did succeed. I guess I won't say why that's ironic. I don't know. We're really spoiling a lot, so. And maybe I should just stop pretending that I'm not spoiling it.
The problem is like, you know, if you're going to be interviewed on Good Morning America, they're just going to say, hey, what's your book about? And what's your writing schedule now that you have kids and all that? What do you do?
Right, right,
I mean,
right.
I could ask you those if you want.
That would be pretty boring.
Yeah.
This,
I mean,
is better.
I think this is much better. And the other thing is, not to pat myself on the back because it was so easy to do, but you can see I read it closely.
I'm very impressed.
But it's because of you, not me. It's because when you get caught up in these things, like I said, when you remember the characters, well, look, that's the other thing about the cover. I own an independent bookstore. So, and I say this in every interview, you know, everyone says you can't judge a book by its cover, but every single person who comes into my bookstore.
Yeah. We totally do.
That's why
probably will.
And that's
stop.
Why that's why publishers get to do it and not authors, because publishers know what works.
Yeah.
And I can guarantee you that in my store, yeah, that's, you can see people, you know, gravitate towards it because of that.
Yeah, good. Well, I hope lots of people will come into your store more than have been coming into most of the stores.
Yeah, I know. I just was reading about the Strand yesterday in New York, and you know.
That's really a sad one.
Yeah, I know. There's lots of questions about that one. But in any event, yeah, now we're still only open 4 days a week. But it's so funny because it seems like we're doing better because that's where people want to go.
Oh, yeah. Well, that's good. That's great.
Yeah, it has been great. And it's taught me a lot, too, that I didn't know about the business itself, even though I've been doing it for 10 or 15 years. But yeah, in any event, I guess, hey, do you actually know Oxford? Have you been to Oxford? Because you did a really good job of.
Thank you. Yeah, I spent the better part. I haven't spent a ton of time in Oxford. I spent the better part of a summer there when I was in college, and it was at Oriel College, which is why I said it there, because that's what I remembered best. And then, of course, you know, there are a lot of pictures of Oxford to fill in my, you know, where my memory was fuzzy. For me, Oxford is one of those places that exists sort of more, sort of, like has more existence than other places because I've read about it so much. You know, it's the site of so many of the books that I loved when I was growing up, or, you know, when I was in college, just, and then a lot of times the authors who are writing books set in Oxford are themselves super attached to Oxford and writing about Oxford in this nostalgic way. And it feels very imbued with significance to me. And, so it was really fun to write about for that reason, because it just felt like I was taking part in this sort of long literary tradition of writing about Oxford.
Yeah, even like his Dark Materials, Philip Pullman, you know, same.
Right. Yep. Yeah.
So, okay, I'll ask one Terry Gross question in conclusion, which would be like, so what are you working on? What are you working on now?
Okay. So in one way, I am working on my book that comes out in fall 2021. It's called Bright Ruined Things, and it's a sort of a 1920s fantasy retelling of The Tempest. I'm working on, it's done. The edits are done. So the work right now is more like promo-y stuff. And then I'm also working on a project that is kind of unnamed at this point, but it's set in like Celtic Iberia, Roman occupied Celtic Iberia. That's kind of all I got right now, but it's fun. It's got a whole new whole shelf of research books in my library. So,
well, it's pretty cool that you just, you know, because this is your first one.
This is my first one. Mm-hmm.
So what kind of kicked, I mean, you got all this other stuff going on and your family too. So what kind of got you kickstarted?
You know? I wrote a book before Golden Fury, and it took me 7 years. And the reason it took me 7 years is because it was just a hobby. I was just doing it for fun. And then by the time I finished it, I realized, oh, hey, I actually can do this. Like, I wrote a book. I think I might know how now. So then after that, it didn't take me 7 years. And I just, I always had stories sort of living in my head. And when you have that, you really want to write them down. And I think I would still be writing them down even if I wasn't doing it now as a career.
When you get optioned to Netflix, if you
and
when you become famous, then the last that'll become your backlist. Your 7-year project will get published with the same kind of cover, and
like when Stephanie Meyer had that weird Body Snatchers book that came out after Twilight.
Yeah, and it's like Gillian Flynn. When I interviewed her, it was right before.
I love her.
It was Bond Girl had just come out, and then all these other books with the same kind of picture came out afterwards.
Oh,
same thing with JoJo Moyes. Same thing.
Oh, right. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, anyway, it's been great talking to you, and it was a great book. And like I said, it's not, you know, yeah, there's a couple of copies in the YA, but you're also on the front table because.
Oh, thank you. That's great to hear.
Yeah, I know they have. I know they're going to give you a label, and you don't necessarily dislike the label, but you know, I enjoyed it as much as some kids going to. So.
Yeah, it is. I mean, it's aimed at teenagers, but I think everybody remembers being a teenager. You know, like it's not that hard to get back into that time of your life and enjoy the story.
Right. That's why I read it in one sitting.
Great. That's awesome. I love hearing that. That's my favorite compliment. That and I stayed up past my bedtime. Those are my favorite.
Oh, yeah. 4 o'clock in the morning. That was a pain in the ass.
That's great. I love it.
Okay. Hopefully we'll talk again soon. Good luck.
Yeah. Thank you so much.